Hello everyone, and welcome to the Death by Adaptation podcast, a bi-weekly book club where we choose one classic book and compare and contrast it against cinematic adaptations. I'm your host, Niccolo Grasso, and I'm joined, as always, by the great Ewan Gledo. How are you doing, Ewan? What's happening in your life?
Not much, really. I was just enjoying your blooper reel there. Hello. Not much going on. Obviously, at the time of recording, I'm officially on holiday now. Which for a holiday for me means traveling around the country, going to gigs, and then reviewing them. So it's not really much of a holiday, but it does mean a holiday for writing about Charles Bronson at the moment, who is kind of in the news because of his parole hearing, and recently revealed that his favourite part of prison was the time he got naked and smothered himself in Lurpak butter and had a fight. Which we've all been there. We've all had that law.
But, of course, no, yeah.
Doing good. obviously, you said before we started this recording you wanted to pick my brain a bit on why I chose the book and the film we're doing currently.
I'm so excited.
I can only apologize.
You shouldn't. I like when we talk about something. It's a bit more challenging, and challenging can mean many different things, you know. But in this case, this is more of a challenge of both structure and content. That's what I will say.
As always,
yeah, of course. As always, if you're listening to this episode, you're on Spotify, YouTube, Apple, wherever you're listening to us, consider subscribing, following, leaving a like, you know, sharing this with your friends and family members who are super into reading. That would help us out a lot. And now, without further ado, let's talk about William S. Burroughs' Naked Lunch.
You got quite a record, Bill. A lot of drugs poured down the old vein.
I was a troubled person then. I'm married now, straight. Got a good job.
That's good, Bill. It's nice. What's this then?
It's my job. I use it to kill bugs.
It says it kills bugs.
He could be right. I'd like to see it.
Me too. I'd like to see it too.
Well, gee. I'd like to demonstrate, but I already got rid of that last case of crabs I had.
Very funny, Bill. But you know, I think we got a bug around here somewhere.
You're right. Let's see if that yellow stuff will kill it.
William Lee, I have arranged all this just to have a moment alone with you. I am your case officer.
My what?
Case officer. You are my agent. I in turn report to your controller. Come, Mr. Lee. You don't have to play dumb with me.
William S. Burroughs, a controversial writer to say the least, but also one of the seminal American writers of the mid-20th century. Someone who very much created this unique, some people say stream of consciousness, style of writing. Others would say vignette writing. There's a lot of different ways of looking at his work. But he is a unique writer, to say the least, influenced by drugs and by his queer experiences in the U.S. after the first two world wars. He has written, after a couple of books, including Junkie, that we'll briefly touch on, he wrote, in 1959, Naked Lunch, which is... Ewan, what is Naked Lunch? And so, why did you choose this book? Because this was a trip, to say the least, in many ways.
Yeah, it's a difficult one to explain because... Obviously, with Junkie, it's more of a straightforward... Well, not I say straightforward. It's more of a...
Comparatively speaking, it is.
Comparatively. If you've read Junkie and then Naked Lunch, you'll think, well, that was positively normal. Junkie was obviously kind of autobiographical, sort of charting William S. Burroughs' heroin addictions and his experiences. I read it back-to-back with Catcher in the Rye, and I thought, wow, these are pretty similar. Not enough... sort of thought process for me to discuss why, because it was about 2 years ago now, but it was really nice to return to Naked Lunch, which again, it's been about 3 years since I've read this, which doesn't sound like a long time, but used to have a lot longer hair back then and was not a journalist. So it's passage of time is terrifying, as described in Naked Lunch. It is a confusing sort of vignette experience about the dangers of drugs and addiction and sex and all those dastardly things in a part of the, I guess in that time was kind of looked down on as kind of, oh, what are you doing? That's really not good. Obviously, it's still looked down on today to take heroin. But back then, when it was kind of in an unrefined state, when people were experimenting with drugs like Tom Wolfe and the sort of acid Kool-Aid test and stuff like that, it's a very, very satisfying read because of how sort of demented it is. A lot of comparisons can be made to sort of like Hunter S. Thompson and stuff, who sort of refined what they were doing with drugs in their writing. William S. Burroughs is quite clearly the other end of the spectrum, even if Hunter S. Thompson was an extreme example of that. Not the first time this year we've talked about heroin on the podcast. I assume it won't be the last either.
Probably.
But I kind of want to, before we even get started with Naked Lunch as a text, I do want to throw this to you. What do you think, now that we've obviously covered Trainspotting a couple months ago now, and a couple pieces of criticism at the time were that it glorified the use of heroin. How does Naked Lunch stand up compared to that criticism?
Oh, it's completely different, because in a way, I don't want to say actually completely different. Let me rephrase that. I think that what Welsh writes in Trainspotting is following a group of you know, young adults, pretty much in their 20s, early 20s, who are throwing their life away. But there's a lot of humor. There's a lot of very peculiar and fun things that happen to them, including as well some tragic ones that, of course, are present to kind of criticize and demonize drug use, especially heavy drugs. But what I like about Burroughs is that he's very analytical about it. In the restored text of Naked Lunch, there's this whole part where he literally runs down all of the drugs that he has used, and he compares them to how the public perceives them and how they actually work, you know. And he especially is a very strong defender of weed, where it's like people say causes addiction. It does not. If anything, it's the least dangerous drug you can have. Alcohol and smoking normal cigarettes is more harmful than weed. Meanwhile, you know, there's all those other drugs, very weird names, that can kill you if you take just a little bit of more of it than you should. And it's so clinical in his approach that it really does feel informative. That's something that I found very interesting. It's very informative. Junkie, of course, more so, because it's autobiographical, semi-autobiographical. But Naked Lunch, yeah, just talking about the drug use, yes, that's how I feel about it.
Yeah, it's a bit wild, isn't it? Obviously, I mean, part of Naked Lunch is sort of, it kind of helps to read Junkie before it, which,
yes, I'm so thankful I did. Bless you for thank you for telling me to do that. I was like, you should read Junkie. I was like, yeah, sure, I could do that. It's a short book, you know.
Yeah, Junkie is delightfully short, and it sets up a lot of what Naked Lunch is about, and obviously we'll talk about it later, but it helped David Cronenberg when it came to adapting the film.
Yep.
Naked Lunch as a book, though, was one of the last major books banned in parts of America. It was sort of the last equivalent of, oh, we're going to outlaw a piece of literature for being completely deranged and horrible. And, you know, as far as sort of as books go, this is deeply disturbing and really horrifying, and it really does blur the line. It's that perfect surrealism. And you know, you mentioned there you read Junkie before Naked Lunch. The first time I read Naked Lunch, I just did it by itself and didn't read Junkie, and I thought, well, what a strange fellow Mr. Burroughs is. I feel like Burroughs is really controversial, obviously, for a number of things, be it Naked Lunch or Junkie or, you know, shooting his wife. Yeah.
Just a small, yeah.
Well, that's the thing. I had to be careful with what I said there. I didn't want to get sued by his estate, but the story goes is that the gun fell off the table, as it does in Naked Lunch, the adaptation. Yeah. That it plays fast and loose with parts of his life that most people would not want to write into the fabric of their text. It does not seem to be something that really bothers him. And he pops all sorts of really horrible sort of moments and features and criticisms of the death penalty and observations on sex and culture, and it really is wild. And I think the only way it works is in this sort of state of kind of vignettes and just sort of sketches almost of things that are happening. I suppose the correct word to use is gratuitous. It really is grim.
But it's, one of those things where like you go into some books, you know, knowing they're going to be controversial, knowing they're going to be, you know, like you said, one of the last major novels to be banned in multiple countries. It's not just one of a small, like, you know, some church here and there, some parents association. We don't want this in our library for the children. They might find it. It's not one of those cases. It's like, I was reading it and I thought, man, like, we talked about 50 Shades of Grey. We talked about actual erotica on this podcast. And Burroughs goes beyond that. There's some sequences in here, especially pertaining to an orgy. When I was reading it, and I thought, this is insane. It made me think of you know, of Stephen King. Stephen King wrote certain books while he was on cocaine. Mm-hmm. And you read them, and you can kind of feel that, you know, the substance present in them, because they're a bit like so self-indulgent at times and so prolonged, but still there's a reason and a clarity to it. Burroughs is kind of the same, but in much shorter bites, which makes sort of some strong tonal whiplash where you're just going from chapter to chapter and character to character to place, you're in the real world, you're in this interzone, you're talking about Islam Inc., and then there's like this weird drug that comes from like the black meat or whatever. It's a lot. Like, how did you find this structure? Like, because I personally found it more so than Junkie. I was reading Junkie and I really loved it, even though it is episodic.
Yeah,
I kind of struggled with Naked Lunch in that sense. It was a bit too disjointed for my taste, even though that's by design, which is so fascinating. But it's one of those things that works best for me in retrospect and just thinking about it in hindsight, rather than actually reading it. Like, the actual reading was a bit tiring. Even like, I would have to take breaks in between certain chapters, just like, Jesus, man, what's happening? I need to think about what I'm reading. It's not an easy flow.
It's very disjointed at times. I get why it's intentional, and sometimes it works. I think it works better in the opening third than it does anywhere else, when he's just been introduced to Dr. Benway, when he first starts working for Islam Inc., and you're getting the stuff about the IEDs and the where they've, I think it's either Benway or the main character, where they talk about the sort of dystopia where, oh, they removed the park benches and everybody was sort of the fountains, and it's not meant to remind me of 1984, but it does, because it's just sort of, it's right there and it's so well explained. And I feel like the most important thing for a book like this, if it's going to have no sort of narrative strength to it, is to make it as visual as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And that lends itself very, very well to how William Burroughs writes, because you get the feeling. I mean, obviously Renton in Trainspotting is the best example. So kind of like, you know, Spud and Renton, when they were talking and they would just chat shit, really. They would just talk about nothing. Naked Lunch is that. It's the sort of the junkie craze of, I need to get my next hit anyways, here's about seven pages on, you know, anything at all. I mean, I was flicking through as if I could pick out an example there, but it's really difficult to sort of fragment something and use it as an example of how Burroughs writes, because it changes quite a lot. It runs out of steam, I felt, towards the end. And I don't know if that's more because I'd had my fill or because it's sort of begins to drift a little, because I think somewhere within Naked Lunch he realizes that there's not an objective conclusion to this. There's nothing that you can tie together and say, well, this is how it comes together. But it works better like that. I feel like it's better to sort of burn brightly and sort of fizzle out towards the end than it is to build and build and build towards a conclusion that would wrap it all up. It doesn't need wrapping up. These are just kind of moments of horrible life, and it works really well. My version comes with a nice postscript from Burroughs,
who was
writing sort of after he published it, and I think it was it was him talking to himself about his addictions in the 90s, so it's way on, and it was after thoughts on a deposition. He says, when I say I have no memory of writing Naked Lunch, this is of course an exaggeration, and it is to be kept in mind that there are various areas of memory. Junk is a painkiller. It also kills the pain and pleasure implicit in awareness. And it's those opening lines, the pain implicit in awareness. Naked Lunch, when it first released, obviously, you know, Burroughs was very aware of how he was writing it. The sort of, it's a very, I have no issue with swearing in text or in movies. It's very, very strong. It's very, very, you can see why it was banned by, you know, sort of uptight Americans in the 1950s and 60s. These are active choices that are swirling around in his head. How he writes, I think the sort of disassociation comes from what he was writing, because there is no way a sound mind, like a sane mind, can write any of that. It's madness. But it always kind of reminds me of Neil Young, the musician. He said sort of when creativity goes up, the drugs use goes down. When drugs use goes up, the creativity goes down. Rose is probably the best example of it kind of piecing together in a nice enough way that it works consistently. Obviously, Hunter S. Thompson did a lot, but he sort of petered out towards the end of his career. Burroughs was, you know, at the sort of forefront with really manic writing, which was then adapted into really manic films that began to make Naked Lunch seem like an autobiographical text, when at the time it was kind of just definitely experiences, but not to the extent I would imagine that Burroughs had intended.
I hope not, especially when he gets very violent and very sick.
That's, yeah.
Those parts are rough.
They are rough. And it's, was it difficult to read? I feel like it's a book that can be leveled with that sort of, oh, it's a difficult read, this one, that kind of label to it of, yeah, it's a bit disgusting, makes your stomach a bit queasy.
It wasn't that bad for me, to be honest. In a way, but that's because I'm just desensitized.
Yeah,
at this
we've been
point.
Desensitized. Yeah.
I am addicted to shock, I guess, at this point with the fiction that I consume. Like very very few things tend to actually surprise me and shock me and startle me. This book managed to do that. I think like if I had to single out one chapter, one sequence, this is just going to haunt me forever till the end of my days. It's the double orgy that happens through the book. That's just fucked up. And I was loving every second of it. That's when the novel peaks for me, because it's depravity made by someone who knows how to use it. I think there are a lot of people who paint themselves as provocateurs. One of the names of du jour that are very much in the media spotlight currently, or like 2 days ago, but you know, the internet moves very quickly. 2 days ago is like 2 years ago, from 5 years ago, I don't know. But Sam Levinson with the Idol TV show, there's a lot of controversy around that. And I really don't like him as an artist. I think visually he's a strong filmmaker, but in terms of content, he really misses the mark and the point of using, you know, sex and drugs and violence to actually make a point about something. And I'm reading Naked Lunch, and I'm reading those parts where it's the indulgence in drugs and sex, and it gets to very dark places like pedophilia as well and necrophilia. But it works. You mentioned it earlier, like he's commenting as well on just how dark the human mind and the human spirit can be. And just how malleable the body is as well, you know, how it's transforming, the drugs transform it, and everything that happens while on drugs transforms your perception of life. But it also reminds you that all of these people, doesn't matter how evil they might be, they're still human. And so, you know, like you mentioned, the anti-death penalty statements that he makes in this book, you know, it resonates. And you kind of need those extreme parts to work. That's what they really liked.
It's obviously that is quite the shocking moment for it. And I think it kind of is where the novel peaks, because you've got this massive climax and then kind of petering out and trying to wrap it all up at the same time is a difficult task. But I do maintain that it is so perverse and disgusting that it probably in hindsight puts Burroughs in a rare category of writing about sex well. Which is really strange, obviously, considering the content, the detail, but it makes it convincing, or not in the sort of usual sense, but in the sense of what he's writing about is obviously not believable, but makes sense for the content within. And I'm sure we spoke about this when we did the Jarvis Cocker one about a year ago now. I would say that the only two men that have written successfully about success and sex are William Burroughs and Jarvis Cocker. Two very different sides of it.
Oh, yes.
Obviously, one perverse, one brutal. But I feel like there's still, in a lot of mainstream writing and a lot of writing that we've looked into anyway, there's kind of a disconnect with how it should work. It's usually as sort of a point rather than an expression. And it feels like for Burroughs, it's a really big expression. It's a very important part, as important as the drugs, which is, you know, depraved, violent, crazy. And it's about as good as it gets. I really do. I really loved the... I said IEDs earlier. I meant the ICDs. I'm trying to find the bit where they go into like the hospital and he throws out a chocolate bar and one of them scuttles out from under a bed and just throws it into his mouth and scuttles away. And it's like, that will haunt me for the rest of my days. That really will. It's why I don't have like high bed frames.
There you go.
I just keep them low down. I don't want anybody scuttling out to eat a Mars bar and then like going back in. But I feel like, obviously, we'll get onto the film, but I feel like Burroughs' style is so visually finished. He knows what he's writing, and it's one of those examples where I feel like the best and most obvious example is because I grew up with like the Hunger Games or Harry Potter. You had ideas of what the characters looked like, even though there were details in there like hair color or if they wore glasses, stuff like that. With Burroughs, none of those details are really there. You can just piece them together, but at the same time, it's the specifics that really help him. Stuff like he scuttled out from underneath. It's that use of verbiage that's so important. And I feel like for all the mania that's going on, it's really carefully constructed. I feel like it's so delicate with what your words it's using, because if you just throw words at the text, it's not going to work. You've got to be really careful with how a word leads. And it's a lot of vile sort of descriptors, and it's a lot of seediness and a lot of just sort of sluggish people. Wouldn't work if it was just he said, she said, which I get, because I mean, I read Stephen King's on writing. It's like, if you can't inflict it in the dialogue, then you can't inflict it in the description. I get that. But for something like Naked Lunch, where it blurs the two together almost, I mean, it's a bit like Trainspotting, where instead of speech marks, it's hyphens. Just little changes to the text like that really work well for what Naked Lunch does. I think the pacing in the first third keeps that in mind. It obviously devolves a little bit more than it should have. But I do think, yeah, it is just a bit mad and a bit deranged, but it's also true. Well, kind of.
Kind of, yeah. I think everything comes from a place of truth.
I think that's the fiction thing. Some of it more so than others. I feel like David Cronenberg obviously got it very right and on the money when he paired Naked Lunch and Junkie together and then drew from other parts of his life. But obviously, I don't mean to compare it just because it's drugs, but Trainspotting as well obviously relied on Irvin Welsh's experiences with the drug and how he moved on from it. And there's always something within a fictional text that can be relayed back to the writer. And for something like Naked Lunch, it's kind of most of it. Obviously, some of the more far-fetched things are there too. I feel like, you know, the Islam Inc. and stuff like that, it's so out there that it grounds the rest of the stuff, which without it would sound out there anyway, even though it kind of happened. It's a really nice balance of make the insane sound normal to make it more approachable and then build it up even further from there. It's really quite wonderful. It's mad. It draws on a lot of personal experience of his life, obviously. I feel like there aren't many writers that are that open with their sort of crimes, such as murder, allegedly.
Allegedly, yes.
It's mad, but obviously, you know, yeah. it's defiant. It's madness. And I can't really think of many others that do it like Naked Lunch. Obviously, it's got issues with its pacing. I think that's the big killer. We mentioned that earlier, and you put it better than I did, where it was sort of, it loses that steam after it peaks, and it never comes to that sort of natural conclusion that you would expect of a fictional text. But it's kind of forgivable in a way. But yeah, I'm going to have another sip of water now because I accidentally cut the back of my throat open.
No worries. Well, of course, you can say that some people you know, like you're reading this book, and it's very fair to make the statement, this is unfilmable.
Yeah.
Like, what madman would ever sit down and be like, you know what? Make it lunch. I want to make a movie about that. You know, I just want to adapt that. But thankfully, we do have one Canadian madman, the one and only David Cronenberg. I believe his debut on this podcast, but not the last time we'll be talking about him this year, because we've got a couple more episodes planned, some of his films.
Oh, yes, we do.
Some quality stuff. Stay tuned for more. But, of course, like you mentioned earlier, David Cronenberg was very interested in adapting not just Naked Lunch, but William S. Bruce's life to the silver screen. And he created this mishmash of junky, Naked Lunch, a couple of his other novels from what I gathered, and just his real life, his personal life, and put it together into an experience that's, I would say, unlike any other in the director's filmography, and very much different from most, if not all, of the film adaptations that we've talked about so far. Yes. What are your thoughts, and what was your experience like the first time you watched Naked Lunch and revisiting it for this podcast? How was it?
Oh, wow. So I first watched Naked Lunch, so me and my friends did a Cronenberg binge, and we watched all of his movies way back in October 2019. It's hard to believe that it's been that long. I really enjoyed the first time I watched it, not knowing anything about the text, just kind of, it's a David Cronenberg film. I didn't realize I was that big of a fan of David Cronenberg at the time, but then as I was researching this and doing my notes, which are all in my brain, I didn't realize I've seen all of David Cronenberg's movies. So I've seen them all. I think Naked Lunch is probably...
Makes me so happy.
It's in the top three, for sure. For sure. I adore Naked Lunch as an adaptation. I feel like I can appreciate it more now that I've, you know, read the text twice and then understood it as well, because I feel like a lot of 2020 for me was reading sort of books and novels that people say, oh, you should read this. And it's like, yes, yes, very good. I'll skim that quickly. So it's good to go back to these things and kind of understand it a bit more. Naked Lunch for me, I think it's because I watch them so close to each other, but it reminds me a lot of Barton Fink by the Coen brothers. And I feel like it's because of the seedy nature of it and sort of the housing that people find themselves in, and sort of, I don't even know if there's any overlap in the sense of what it's commentating on, but they just felt something there.
Barton Fink, also 1991 movie.
You know, there you
same
go.
Year.
There must have
been something in the water about, you know, writers, troubled, haunted writers.
Well, that's the thing. I feel like the big change in pace, obviously, from Naked Lunch the text and Naked Lunch the movie, is that David Cronenberg has a lot more to draw on, and he's also got the benefit of hindsight, and he can look into things a bit more, and it's a bit more detail, and it's 30 years on. It's impressive, though, that he managed to take not just two texts, but the life of someone that was still living, and sort of refine it, combust it down into a semi-autobiographical piece that relies on fictional narratives in his books elsewhere. It really does well to blur the line, but at the same time feels completely unique when you've got the sort of the exterminator angle and then Peter Weller's in there, and it's just, it is wonderful. It really is stunning. And it's got that sort of style to it. You know, it's that, I hate the term, oh, nobody else could have directed this. This is a Cronenberg movie. This is like tailor-made for him. Like Fear and Loathing was tailor-made for Terry Gilliam. Or, you know, it's just one of those that really is the perfect matchup. And you don't get many of those where it is sort of the meaning of those two minds works so well. Obviously, the body horror helps, but there is a straight shooting narrative in there that relies on people like Roy Scheider, where it's wonderful.
Glorious, glorious Roy Scheider in here. Ian Holm as well. Shout out to Julian Sands.
The man himself.
The man himself, who's probably dead, RIP, yeah, at this point. Still missing in the after hiking.
Obviously, it was Judy Davis is in this as well, who doesn't get enough far. She does not receive enough credit that she is due. Again, was in Barton Fink.
So, it's all connected. It's all connected.
It is. It's all connected. They did it on the same set or something. I
so
swear
just jumping from one into the other.
There's more crossovers than that between the two, and I feel like that's why I've pieced them together in my mind. I feel like it's because Barton Fink is still a little bit unhinged. Obviously, it's about a writer, but there's also the big thing I remember. Obviously, spoilers for Barton Fink if you've not seen a 30-year-old movie yet.
Great movie.
Great movie. One of my
favorite. Check it out and come back here to continue to listen.
Do you think they're back? Right, they're back.
Yeah, they're back. Thank you for watching it.
Great movie.
Great movie, right?
John Turturro. The bit where the apartment's on fire and it's just John Goodman in that blaze. I feel like if you slice that image into Naked Lunch, it would not feel out of place. It would feel like it was meant to be there. A lot of that, I mean, I hate to play as a writer that card, but I want to know what you thought of this scene actually before I explain it. The scene where his typewriter turns into the giant cockroach for the first time and it has a keyboard instead of its mouth and it's talking out of its anus. What did you think of that?
It's glorious. It's a glorious scene. No, but even just in general, this movie for me, the first time I watched it, I think it was similar to you. Like, I was kind of going through Cronenberg's filmography, trying to, because I seen all of his big movies, but I was like, let's watch some of the uncut gems, some would say, of his work. And I watched Naked Lunch again, not knowing anything about it other than it's an impenetrable movie, an impenetrable work of art. And it floored me. I didn't necessarily love it, but it stuck with me. You know, it's a very unique film, to say the least. But I was actually super lucky to revisit it recently on the big screen at Berlinale. They were showing the remastered version of it, the 4K. And seeing it on the big screen with loudspeakers, with a crowd, made me realize one key thing. This movie is fucking hilarious.
Oh, yes.
So this movie funny. Is so funny. It's one thing to just be, you know, by yourself in a room just chuckling when there's like something weird. But it's another thing to have an entire auditorium of people just laughing at this typewriter that turns into an alien's head with Peter Weller's boots just shoving his hands through it to write. And this weird, like, penis hairs coming out of his head and just start dripping liquid while he's writing. It's mad. It's mad. I don't know. It's not even a thing of the 90s. Just there's no decade where someone would actually greenlight this movie. Like, this is, like, we're living in the best timeline where David Cronenberg got so many movies greenlit. It's insane. And just revisiting and re-experiencing that the first time, The typewriter turns into a cockroach. It's glorious. It's glorious because it's I forget who voices the cockroach.
Peter Boretsky.
Peter Boretsky. It's just this, you know, this baritone lower timbre voice that makes it so much funnier because it's the entire movie is kind of a spoof, you could even say. Among so many things that it's about, it is almost a spoof of noir cinema. And so to have, you know, this stereotypical the noir voice, Bill, you have to do this thing, but just coming out of a cockroach typewriter, like, no, not even, from a cockroach typewriter's anus, it's on top of it. It's just, it's so good, the effects and everything. Oh, it's
something
insane.
Something snapped in my brain. Obviously, we were talking about, sort of before the podcast, how I'm once again burnt out and sort of all my writing seems the same.
Just a constant state of mind in between episodes.
I do a good patch of about 3 articles and then I hit a brick wall every month. But it's when the cockroach says, yes, that's a good sentence. It's like, yeah, that's what my brain does when I write something. I guess I'm just a cockroach, but I'm sure some people would agree. But no, that scene for me kind of spoke a lot, not just in sort of the sense of what Burroughs was doing at the time and how he's writing, but it kind of, not to be selfish, but I kind of just started putting myself in that scene where it's like, you do get a bit scared when you're writing too much and you know, you do try and bottle it with a wine bottle and sort of walk towards the door, but then you sit down and you get a few sentences going and it's all part of it. And I feel like that was at the core of Naked Lunch. Obviously, it's very funny. One of the best lines is, I'd like you to meet a friend of mine. He specializes in sexual ambivalence. And the reply is, sexual ambulance, you say, which is just wonderful. But there is, underneath all of that, a real desire to profile one of the most well-known writers of the generation. Mm-hmm. And I feel David Cronenberg does a great job I don't think it can be knocked for sort of being disturbing or gruesome, because that's what the writing is. It's a successful adaptation on those grounds, and I've just got a soft spot for body horror in general and sort of physical props. It reminds me a lot of John Carpenter's stuff in The Thing.
Yes.
The grease that comes through it. It's like just the sickly nature of it. And it is one of those films I would love to watch in a theatre. Mainly because I remember when we went to see Banshees at the festival.
Yes.
And that was just, it was such a warm feeling. Despite the dark undertones to it, there was a real warmth in the room of people just laughing. And Naked Lunch just looks like the perfect one to do it with. If I ever got the chance to sort of, what's the word? Curate a festival.
Mm-hmm.
First
mm-hmm.
opening day, Naked Lunch and Barton Fink is a double bill.
Oh, yes. Oh, invite me, I'll come. Oh, yeah. Come over and I feel enjoy.
Like I've got Barton Fink on Blu-ray and I've got Naked Lunch on her. Which I'm sure. did you know that Liam Neeson's Marlowe film's out today, by the way?
I did.
Anyways, yeah.
Is that going to be a desperate adaptation? No.
Oh, yes, absolutely. No. I'm so glad you thought of that. Yeah, let's do an extra one. I tell you what, cancel my holiday plans. I'm going to read Philip Marlowe.
Just the entire collection.
Oh, man.
The non-canonical works.
But I'm sure, this is a Criterion collection film, isn't it? I'm sure it is.
I know it's Criterion. I believe Arrow released a special edition of it. Okay. I have a friend of mine who got it, and it looks sick. He showed me like some pictures of it. I was like, oh man, I want that. It looks so good.
I hate to be a stickler, but I do prefer Arrow, because the Cronenberg releases I've got from them are just stunning. They're so, so well made. I think the one I've got is Videodrome, which Videodrome again kind of feels a bit similar in the sense of how dark it gets, how grisly it gets, but Naked Lunch, man, is just, it's somewhat really special when you can get the guy from Jaws to play a role like this. I mean, it's the moments in the first third that really stick with me. That first 40 minutes where it's building towards something, that's when it feels that at its peak. I feel like Dr. Benway from Schneider is unbelievable, probably one of his best roles. It's just such a capitulation at the end. It's just a joy.
I think just for, you know, even for posterity's sake, because we will be talking about some more Cronenberg, I want to kind of put it here as well, just the fact that this is very, at first glance, it doesn't feel like a Cronenberg film. It feels a bit weird for him to be doing this, but actually there are so many themes, like we talked about that in the book Naked Lunch. Like there is a lot of this obsession and fascination with, you know, changing bodies and changing minds, and that's something that Cronenberg has always been about. And it's even interesting, I was looking at his filmography and thinking, like, when did he make this movie? And this one came out in between Dead Ringers and Butterfly, both incredible films. Especially that Dead Ringers is probably one of my top. I don't know, Cronenberg is like David Lynch, you know, like if you were to make a top, like you would have unanimous, like 10, maybe 7, 8 movies at the top spot. Yeah. Like they're all number one. Depends on the day. Dead Ringers is that type of movie for me. Yeah. But it was definitely becoming more of a, I would say more mature entering mm-hmm. the 90s, oh, yeah. Because it was taking this more overt interest, not just with sociological issues through a lot of extreme gore, but also he was starting to analyze, you know, psychological stories even deeper. And I think Naked Lunch is this interesting bridge between, together with Dead Ringers, just, you know, this body transformations that are so nasty. And the element of drugs, of addiction is present throughout this movie. Like everything that we're seeing is essentially Bill Lee, that's the main character's name, Bill Lee's visions of this twisted world where he's just high on this insecticide and he's just hallucinating some very, very grotesque, yes, and out, yeah, of this world things. And even compared to the book, I especially rewatching it, I do think this structurally is much tighter, because even when there are some lulls here and there, I think when he goes to the North African country, unnamed North African country, is it the Interzone, I think that's the name of the place, something like that, But when he goes to this country, you can... there are some moments where he's just talking with a lot of people, and it's starting... Maybe you're starting to lose a bit of focus. Oh, Ian Holm is on screen. Okay. Feeling a bit tired. Oh, one of the cockroach typewriters is eating up another one of the cockroaches because that one was a spy sent there by the Islam Inc. to take over and control it. And the writing has to be done in a weird... What's happening here? What's going on? Like, it's... insane. It's insane. And even this whole idea of the doppelganger, you know, like, I didn't realize the first time around, the doppelganger of the wife, by the way, because he kills the wife, like you mentioned, similarly to how Burroughs himself actually accidentally killed his wife. And they realized it on rewatch that this movie is all about the writing process and how sometimes you need something very traumatic to push you into being a better artist, a better writer.
Yeah.
And the entire idea of, okay, this man wants to be a writer. He's working as a bug. Exterminator.
Yeah, yeah.
The bug man. It's like, oh, Jesus.
The bug man?
English is hard.
You're not wrong. He was a bug man.
And there are literally bug men in this movie as well.
Yes, there are, yeah.
But he's working as an exterminator. He's frustrated, he's doing drugs, he accidentally kills his wife, and he goes on the run, and this makes him want to write, and it kickstarts his creative process in a way that he ends up writing the actual book, Naked Lunch, in the movie, and it all leads to him falling in love again with a woman that's the exact same woman as his wife, just a literal doppelganger. But in the end, he has to kill her if he wants to flee from Interzone and go to another country to actually work as a writer. He has to have loss. He needs the trauma. He needs the tragedy. Because without that, he's nothing. I think it's the first time around, the ending left me cold. I didn't really get it. And rewatching it, I was like, oh, shit. I get it now. I get it. Like, artists are troubled people. They are broken people every time. Doesn't matter what artists you're looking at, they have a lot of fears, a lot of regrets. And I think that Cronenberg himself is someone who has experienced that and who has put it in his movies multiple times. And so to, you know, kind of criticize in a way Burroughs' life and Burroughs' writing and to deliver such a profound understanding of the creative process and the inevitability of trauma leading to better art.
Yeah, no, I agree with that completely, yeah.
It's like, Jesus, man.
it's very deep in that regard. And obviously, you know, after reading Junkie and sort of seeing that process and then just seeing other writers that I'm a fan of or I admire or kind of look up to when I do my own stuff, they've lived horrible lives, awful, awful lives. And it's always sort of, I mean, I mentioned Neil Young earlier where it's kind of David Crosby, I meant, not Neil Young. I hope they've listened long enough to hear me make that change. You never want to confuse the two. But anyways, yeah, so it was David Crosby that said, you know, drugs in... You can edit that. David Crosby. There you go.
Slice it in.
Yeah, we all make mistakes, as William Burroughs did when he accidentally shot his wife. yes. So the whole sort of creative process, woe is me kind of agony thing, is a lot of stand-up comedy. It's the age-old misery loves comedy type thing. Wasn't given much credence in the past few years leading up to that big sort of, oh, I'm sad, here's my story on stage type thing, which appeals to people. I don't really get it. But the key to that is that a lot of great art has tragedy behind it. Obviously, I mean, I watched Apocalypse Now recently, and the tragedy behind that that came out of such a great film is monumental. But obviously, we've got to look at films that don't really have tragedy behind it and were just, you know, quite well made at the time. Couldn't name you any, but Pulp Fiction, probably. Every bit of art that I enjoy, it just so happens that behind it is either something disgusting, like Naked Lunch, like filth, like Trainspotting, or some sort of brutal experience for the people that were making it, like Heart of Darkness, like Pulp's This Is Hardcore album, like Naked Lunch. And it all just, it feels like a necessity because it's somewhere to draw from. You can't draw and make these experiences without having either experienced it yourself or having some sort of basis for drawing from it. You know, you can't write that if you've not experienced it. Much in the sense of David Cronenberg. You know, the body horror stuff was really popular in the 80s and then into the 90s, but it's rather telling that he started and ended the decade with two of his strongest body horror films. So he did Naked Lunch and then Existenz. I don't know how it's pronounced. The one about VR.
Existenz. Oh.
Yeah. But both of those are great examples of what his style was at the time. And it just so happens that it really benefits the sort of visualization, because Naked Lunch is a very visual novel. It's a really staggering, in-your-face acceptance of a lot of different themes, and a lot of them make their way over to the adaptation. Obviously, a couple of them kind of don't make it into the cut. I feel like the sort of death row stuff and the hangings and stuff don't quite make it over, because the focus is actually on the biographical part. David Cronenberg does a really good job of cutting and changing what he needs to. It's kind of one of the best unofficial fictional biography films you'll get with such a great cast. But again, it's that David Cronenberg charm. It's The Fly, it's the Videodrome sort of body horror, but mixed in with elements of stronger storytelling that he'd rely on and stuff like History of Violence, The Recent Promises.
Yeah.
Nice pairing of the two. I don't think he did it as good as that again, where he sort of bled the two into one another. Maybe Dead Ringers, obviously before it. And maybe Spider as well. Spider always sort of lurks in the background as a dark horse for his filmography.
I think probably the closest he ever got to making a... I'm looking at his filmography now. As like Naked Lunch. I mean, I haven't read it yet, but maybe Cosmopolis a little bit has some of that, tangentially speaking. But more than anything, maybe because I watched it recently, but Crimes of the Future feels like it has a lot of the same DNA as Naked Lunch, in just, you know, world building and very bizarre humor. That's always been present, of course, in his filmography, but even more so in retrospect after we watched Naked Lunch, which again, I think if it weren't for like Peter Weller's performance, that's very, very calm, very stoic, and very just, you know, I love that he's just accepting everything that's happening. You know, there's just this weird bug creature just talking to him, the Wombuck. Wombuck, something like that. Wombuck. Just those bizarre names. And he's just like, you know, like rolling up a cigarette going, okay, that's all right. Okay, sure. just going with the flow, you know. Easygoing man. It's just an incredible performance.
It's the acceptance of madness. You just got to accept it sometimes.
Yes.
You know, it's one of those things.
It's amazing.
Superb.
So, Yuan, as always, this leads to the final, ultimate question of this podcast. What do you think is best, or what is your favorite? The book by William S. Burroughs, or the film by David Cronenberg?
I feel like, you know, obviously, you know, they're both titled Naked Lunch, they're both about the same thing. These are two so massively different.
Yes.
But at the same time, feel so closely tied. Obviously, Naked Lunch is barbaric, it's insane, and it runs out a lot of steam, but before that, it's borderline perfect in places. The film is an adaptation of that, but also an autobiography, and then a little bit of extra bits and pieces are thrown in as well. I was really confident when I came into this, and I was going to say that the film is better than the book, and it's like, yep, perfect, no worries. And as we've talked, I've been thinking like, but yeah, then that happens in the book, and then yeah, and then... And then that's mused on quite well, and that's quite nice. And it really, I'm going to say the book tentative. Okay. I'm going to go with my gut. I'm going to go and say the book. If you'd asked me before we'd recorded this, which would have defeated the purpose, I would have said the film. But I feel like it's reading that postscript that did it for me the second time round, where he's kind of like, you know, speaking personally about his addictions and why people get addicted. You know, and he puts it quite nicely. Only excuse for this tired death route is the kick when the junk circuit is cut off for the non-payment, and the junk skin dies of junk lack, an overdose of time, and the old skin has forgotten the skin game, simplifying away under the junk cover the way skins well. Doesn't mean it's meaningless, but it's so powerful in the sense of it's written with conviction, and I'm inclined to agree with it, whatever it means. Obviously, it's difficult to adapt that to the film. I love the film. I really do. I just feel like Naked Lunch as a text is a bit broader in that mm-hmm. sense of its legacy behind it doesn't really impact me when I make these decisions. But for Naked Lunch, one of the last banned books, it's insane. Which I didn't expect when I first came on, because when I first started this, I thought, oh yeah, I'm going to pick the film because it does a lot for the sort of state of writing and how people get into that zone of writing. Like when they're in the coffee shop and the guy comes over and starts making jokes about his typewriter, it's really bizarre, but that is essentially just a newsroom. But I'm sure I'll be able to talk about stuff like that in a later episode we've got planned. For now, I'm going to go with the book for Naked Lunch.
Okay. That's very fair, very fair. I will actually go with the movie this time around. There was just something I think, you know, I like a consistent experience. that's how I am. Even though I'm super, like, even though I wasn't the biggest fan of Naked Lunch while reading it, it has stuck with me over the past week since I finished it. Yeah. I think it's probably going to stick with me for a while longer as well. but the movie was very special, you know. The movie's kind of like having a friend you don't really appreciate him or her, or you don't really appreciate them for whatever reason until you actually meet up after like years of not having been together. Like, man, you know what? They were so much better than I gave them credit for, and I want to be their real friends from now on. That's how I feel with Naked Lunch. It's like, why didn't I support you more when I first saw you? Like, why wasn't I there for you? I'll be there now, which is why I'm choosing David Cronenberg's Naked Lunch, which makes me so happy. And I really hope you will be able to watch it on the big screen, because it was such a unique experience. Like, probably if I hadn't seen it on the big screen, I might actually be more, you know, hesitant in giving it this, you know, this spot between the two of, like, of trumping the novel.
Yeah.
Because it's such a special, special experience.
Yeah.
It's but anyway... Nice. Yeah, it's mad. It's you know when the, you know when they that. Say it's a trip, something is a trip. This is literally a trip. Like, it's a drug fueled trip, both the novel and the film, and it's one of a kind.
Yeah, one of a kind is the way to describe it. I don't think I'll ever get anything like this again, which is probably for the best.
Yeah. Shout out to Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg for supporting. For supporting their friend Burroughs through the decades. That's an interesting friendship. And we might be coming back to Jack Kerouac later this year. Who knows? We'll see.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
We'll see.
We saw.
But for now, this is it for this episode of the Death Adaptation Podcast. Yuan, where can our listeners find you on social media and online if they wanted to, you know, catch up with some of your quality writing and quality journalism?
Well, why on earth would you want to do that? you can find me in all the usual places, Twitter and Letterboxd at Euangledo, Euangledo. You can get me on Rate Your Music at Euan or Ewano. Because to be fair, I mean, I've spoken to people that use Letterboxd and stuff still. I use that solely to promote my writing. I don't care for the community aspect of it because they're feral. There are only so many one-line jokes I can take, dominating with 3,000 likes. you can also find my work on cult following, Daily Star, Daily Mirror, Newcastle World sometimes, and obviously Don't Listen to This, which is my podcast about music and albums and stuff, which I believe we're recording right after this, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
Oh, yes. I've run out of water. Like, I've run out of bottles of water.
Oh, so, yes, I need to rehydrate as well.
Oh, yeah.
Get those juices back in, you know, talking about Naked Lunch. Such a wet movie. It's liquids.
It's a very moist film. It's very, you can taste it on the air. You know, you can taste that stagnation, which sounds horrible, but people that have read the book know what I mean.
Oh, they do. Of course, stay tuned, because next time we'll be back in 2 weeks, going in a different direction, because, you know, it's nice to balance things out. You can't always go with those dark and challenging and very, very complex books to read. So was time to take a step back and go to lovely, lovely Canada, you know, maybe Cronenberg's country of origin, to read a classic of childhood literature, and also a personal favorite of Randy Burroughs, who will be joining us for next time's episode on Anne of Green Gables. So stay tuned for that. We hope to see you then, and for future episodes, we hope you enjoyed this, and we hope you have a fantabulous day. Bye-bye.